Hello, George.
Hello, John.
Hey, Sam.
Good morning, folks. Afternoon, I guess. Afternoon.
Hello, Sam.
How's the smoke down in Utah, Jack?
Oh, I'm not in Utah. Remember, I'm in Virginia.
You're in Virginia? Why did I think you were in Utah?
I don't know.
I don't know either.
You're up in Idaho?
I'm in Idaho.
That's right.
I'm in Utah. We had bad smoke, and then it rained, and now it was better, and now it's getting worse again. So, from all the West Coast fires.
We had a lot of fires down here in Utah. As a matter of fact, our house, we were evacuated, and the fire came down the hillside and got to about 10 yards from our house. And the local fire department, who, you know, in conjunction with everybody else that was helping fight the fires, a picture of our house and the fire behind it is now their cover page on Facebook for the local fire department.
Well, I'm glad it's a success story instead of we almost saved this one.
I know, right? Yeah. It was touch and go there for a while, but they had a full crew in our driveway fighting the fire, as well as they did the same for our neighbors too. It was quite amazing.
Wow.
Well, I'm glad it worked. So total topic switch, but I just noticed a thing in Zoom. When I hover some people, I can unmute them. When I hover other people, there's an ask to unmute. So I can't just unmute you as the owner of the meeting. That's new. So Brent has that, George has that, and Nathan has that. And everyone else, I can just unmute.
Yeah, that's interesting.
There must be a hack we don't know about.
There's probably a new setting they introduced and they defaulted it to something. Yeah, that's what we don't know.
They also just updated the clients on some platforms, so it is maybe that some of you are waiting for to upgrade.
Interesting. So is Brent, George, and Nathan using a Mac? And everyone else using a PC, or is there something different?
No, I'm using a Mac. This is Jack. And
must be just a distributed rollout.
Yeah.
I'm on an iPad today, and I know the app on this iPad updated just like yesterday.
Yeah.
I'm interesting.
Using 523, Zoom 523.
Maybe they finally realized that just, you know, involuntarily unmuting someone was not necessarily the best answer.
Yeah.
Not that I know of any Zoom fouls that have happened in this community, but I can imagine.
I don't see any option necessarily yet.
I think it's probably just a version update.
What's the feature you're talking about?
So on some, when I hover people as the meeting host, sometimes some people I can just unmute them, and some people I have to ask to unmute. That seems different. So we're observing that we're probably in the middle of a feature rollout that hasn't yet completed yet.
That's probably true.
So actually, I was just thinking, with all the random Zoom issues I've had with other meetings, this one has been relatively free of them. So with that, I will knock on some wood. Does bamboo count as wood? For the knocking of purposes?
It depends on the deity.
On the what?
On the deity.
Oh,
Which deity you're using.
Yeah. It's like the sustainable knocking on wood, isn't it? Isn't bamboo like... If I really wanted to go full sustainable, it would be a hemp fiber-based wood, and then it would
there
be
you go. There
the you most go. Sustainable... option.
And it would have multi uses. It wouldn't just be for knocking.
Actually the hemp that produces the most fiber apparently doesn't produce very good narcotic buds. So
that's gotta good.
Pick. do you want fiber or do you want fun? Apparently.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you're right. The latest version is 5.3.0 and I'm running 5.2.3 and I don't have that feature.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to go ahead and get started after all of our intro banter about Zoom features and variety of knocking woods. A chunk of our agenda came from last week. We deferred. We had really interesting, I think, unplanned, very low attendance. I think there was just too many things competing and the end of summer vacations, et cetera. So we have a couple of issues pulled from last week and a new one that we will be talking about today. So welcome all. Please mind the Hyperledger Code of Conduct and the antitrust policy, that we might be excellent to each other and avoid any legal encumbrances upon the work we have here. This call is recorded and will be posted later back to the bottom of this meeting page after that becomes available. Anyone new that has not introduced themselves that would like to, or really old that would like to, or I guess instead of old that has been here lots before. Okay. Moving along, IW, October 20th through 22nd, entirely online. That's going on. You can go ahead and register for that. It will be similar with the same platform as last time. I'm assuming there will be a tweak or two, but that worked pretty well last time. So I think that will be excellent. Related meetings, I'll start with the DIDCOM working group. We had a really good conversation about ways to end a relationship. To signal to the other party that you are no longer going to be maintaining your part of it. And the concept that if you needed to send meta information contained in headers, perhaps you can send a message with no message type at all. And it ends up being sort of an envelope with nothing inside of it. And so those were good conversations, lots going on, and invite you to participate there if you would like to. This morning, Aries call, had some conversation about architecture of reusable libraries and the process of creating RFCs for those. Stephen, Andrew was not in that conversation, but Robert mentioned that he had talked to him about some related topics. But I think that the process of sort of getting those into RFC form and discussing those will be a good venue for good discussion around what we can do there. I bring up Andrew. I invoke Andrew because he's done a whole lot of work along those sort of common things.
He has, and I'll mention that when we get to that section.
Cool.
As well.
Other related meetings we want to highlight?
Tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Mountain Time is the Identity Implementers Call, where we go over a variety of topics from a wide range of working groups. Also, for our presentation tomorrow, Kevin and Philip from a company called Score will be giving a presentation of the Canis project. And they call that the Extensible RESTful Credentialing Hub. And as I understand it, it's written in Framework Go. So there's a lot of interesting topics they'll bring and present to us tomorrow.
They've also done a Go wrapper for Ursa that they're working on.
Cool.
Excellent.
Yes, had a conversation with Philip today. So earlier. Cool, awesome. That will be a good call. All right, project updates. Aries Protocol Test Suite.
Sorry, I was trying to unmute. Just a reminder that we added the out of band protocol. The phase one testing. So that's there for anyone who wants to make sure you're compliant with phase one. And again, welcome for anyone who wants to be on the Friday meetings. We have some good discussion. Thanks.
Thank you, Keith. Aries Agent Test Harness.
Yeah, working on revocation test cases. So a set of tests were defined And now they're being implemented on in the Akamai back channel. That'll define the back channel changes needed, and we'll go from there.
Area shared libraries.
So the big thing that we've been talking to Andrew about this week is basically he's going to start working on, I don't think he's on the call. He could answer if he was, but I don't see him. He's going to start working on an Akamai version that builds on those. So he's done an awful lot lately in what's called now Aries Askar, which is what the storage, the Aries storage layer that he's implemented will be. And basically that more or less completes the ability to eliminate in the SDK. And so now it's a matter of, using those to create an Akamai version that is no longer dependent on in the SDK.
So that was ASKAR? Is that an acronym?
ASKAR. No. Shoot. There was a discussion of why it's named that, and I can't remember where it is. It's something about guarding things.
Okay. So I should.
ASKAR is another name for Hamel, the brightest star in the Aries constellation, also means guard or soldier. So it is the brightest star in the Aries constellation. Aha. I see why he went there and means guard or soldier. So there you go.
Perfect. Okay. That makes tons of sense. Yeah. Cool. Look forward to hearing more about that. That'd be awesome. He's presented on it before, but I imagine there's been some progress since then.
Yeah. Lots of cool progress.
Nice. Aries Cloud Engine Python.
5.5 is just pending. So we've been trying to get one of our common use cases, our one we've talked about a fair amount, out to actually putting credentials in the hands of arbitrary lawyers in British Columbia. That's very close, and we ran into a big, we keep running into roadblocks with revocation. As of yesterday, we think we've solved, we understand at least, solved is an interesting word to use, but we at least understand what's happening with revocation now, so that we are confident now that we can communicate revocation back and forth. So release 5.5 deals with being able to recover revocation registries if something goes bad in the handling. And then, as I say, we've been working with the wallet providers, and especially the AriesFramework.net folks, to figure out why revocation works in some, doesn't work in others, and why. And so we understand now the inner workings of indie revocation, which I'd like to talk about on this call because it's kind of relevant.
Yes, that's we have that the Aries involved community. In the.
Yeah.
That's on our schedule. So that's perfect.
Awesome.
Excellent. Aries Framework Go. All right, and Aries SDK Ruby, Jack.
Oh, no, nothing this week.
Okay. I don't see Thomas Lauber, another member of the .NET group. On the toolbox, I will mention that I am working on adding mediation support to the toolbox so that it can use a mediator. This gives it the feature of being able to connect to another agent that also uses a mediator and is also not running on the same local box. This will add a couple of useful features, but also gives you the ability to exercise a mediator directly, which is convenient. So that's in progress. Other work, Aries Framework JavaScript. All right, and any rich schemas or credential work since we have Brent?
Nothing to report.
Okay. Mobile agent Xamarin. And any updates from Ursa?
I guess I pre-updated. We have some contributors from Score making a Go wrapper for us, which is fantastic.
Cool. Okay. On the agenda today, I have one item on the in the closing game that I want to talk about, and that has to do with the community coordinated type message type transition, moving to phase two. I have a bunch of questions about my attempt and as a for an initial framework for the machine readable governance framework for identifiers. I'll get to that in a minute. And I have some questions there. I was caught Kyle, I don't see in the meeting, but he also added some questions that are super relevant. And then I wanted to spend a couple of minutes doing a DIDCOM version 2 what's new presentation. Some of you will have heard this before, but and I can go rather fast if we need to, but that way we can kind of cover some stuff. And then I'm curious about topics that that non-regular DIDCOM attendees are curious about. And that way we can sort of take that back and make sure that we get the important stuff covered. And then a discussion about indie revocation issues in Aries. That was the conversation Steve was talking about before. Any updates needed to the agenda before we get going? All right. Number one is the transition of phases from, this is the 348, the transition message type to HTTPS, community coordinated update. Stephen submitted this PR, which moves it to the adopted state. And as such, changes step one from in progress to done, meaning that agents can accept both the old and the new message types. And then we default to sending out the message types in the old format. And step two now moves to in progress, which means that we're actually start sending out the new format and the new message types and still accept the old ones. And that will allow us, in theory at least, to transition with minimal disruption between between these two formats as we migrate away from using it that did as the base. Any comments or questions about this? About this change in the move forward in the community coordinated update. I hear crickets. That means everyone's happy or everyone's mad. One open question, Stephen, you asked here was whether the other RFCs that still relate to the, that still, you know, display the old message type should be updated as part of this PR or in a follow-up.
So in the community update process, the generic one that says, here's how we do this generically, it does say that the transition from one to two generally includes updating all the RFCs impacted by that. That is a pretty, that is going to be a pretty easy change, but it's like 100 and it's many, many RFCs and 100 odd files. And I'm happy to make that, but I would prefer it to be just a mechanical follow-on to this one versus part of this one. And I definitely wanted to have this discussion without anyone noticing that, by the way, we're changing 168 different RFCs.
The diff will be a lot smaller files. Under this view, right? Yeah.
Yeah, the diff is a lot smaller. You were able to show it. But, the other one is just going to be a mechanical change where I do a search and replace across the repo. Not a search and replace, a curated search and replace across the repo to make sure we update only the ones that are relevant. For example, in this one, in this RFC, we say, oh, we're going to change from this to this. So we don't want to change it so that we're changing from this same thing to this other same thing. We don't want to make it a global change. So there has to be a little bit of intelligence applied.
Right.
Enough that even I can do it. Enough that even I can
do it. Even you. You underestimate your power, Stephen. So I don't know that I'm particularly bothered by them being separate PRs. That does keep the discussion of the status separate from the mechanical updating. Any objections to accepting this one and then having the other one as a follow-on? All right, I hear no objections. I propose we merge this and add a review. There's a couple of us on the call here that are capable of adding such a review. Will one of you do that so that that's updated and we can merge that? If not, I can do it after the meeting.
I'll do it, just a second.
Perfect, thank you, Daniel. Okay, and then we'll have a follow-on PR that actually updates the RFCs and that's a mechanical change based on this merge, so that's good. Okay, next up on the list is, that's not what I wanted.
Before you move on, can I ask just a general question about these community rollout things?
Uh-huh.
So I know we have this message type one. We have the out of band is in phase one. Are there others that we're doing phase approach that I'm forgetting right now?
Those are it.
Okay.
And again, for the benefit of those listening, this is not something we want to do very often, but occasionally we run into something that for continued interoperability reasons can use an approach like this. What we prefer is to use mechanisms in the protocols themselves to be able to handle updates of this manner. But occasionally it's not possible to solve that in an easy way. So these ought to be rare. But allow us to provide a mechanism for us to coordinate as a community. So there's only the two. There's this one moving into phase two, which is moving away from the old type to the new. And then the other one is adding support for receiving the out of band invitations instead of the connections protocol invitations across the board. So that, and then that one will allows a much easier transition without a community coordinated update to actually support DID exchange instead of the connections protocol.
Okay.
So that one actually contains sort of a better feature to use in the future because of the design of that. Okay. Let me pull this up into render mode. I have taken an attempt. Some of this text you'll have seen before. This is an actual PR now for an email access governance framework. This is renamed from email control or email ownership. Access was a much more accurate name, I thought, for what we're actually demonstrating by being able to click a link. You're not demonstrating that you own the email address necessarily or that you even control it, but that you can access the email coming to that address, which is common, but it's a little more precise. So this is an RFC that outlines, that talks about the goal code satisfied. It talks about the protocols in use to do so, the roles of the people that are involved. It does not yet have schemas and issuers, and there's actually supposed to be a note there, but the markdown didn't render nicely because I used angle braces, which is apparently a no-no for a note. So we need schemas and issuers is what those notes says. And then there are requirements around issues and how revocation is handled. There's also an associated machine-readable document that is being proposed alongside, and that's here. And you'll notice, Daniel, that I took your medium option that can be later expanded to something more rich that allows for the specifying of these things. Among here, for example, this is not quite accurate yet, but this is the docs URI and the data URI to this doc above and the doc below for what they'll actually be. And then there are we need the schema ID here as well, and also the rules that allow the specific issuers to do this. So I have a bunch of questions. There's some of them here, and Kyle's raised a good one. Any questions before we launch into asking those questions? Okay, and asking these questions, I really want to know what you think. So if you're mildly positive at it or whatever else, that's fine. And I'd still love to hear that because that will help me gauge what kind of acceptance or how good of an idea this is or maybe a different approach is needed or any of that. So Kyle brought this up and he mentioned what's the benefit of defining this as a governance framework. And this heavily relates to number two that he asked as well. Is the Aries RFCs the best place for this to go? Might it fit better in the Trust of RIP Foundation repos? And the answer to two is probably in the future. the trust over IP is not designed to be the location of all trust frameworks that are created. This could certainly, I think, have a home there as a general purpose one. So any organization or group or anything, it can create governance frameworks as appropriate. I know of a company looking at creating a governance framework for the use of credentials within the company, for example, and that's perfectly appropriate. The convenient part about putting this particular governance framework in the Aries RFC repo is that it becomes a community managed governance framework that we are using. And that's why it belongs, I believe, in the RFC repos. The second answer is that it allows us to move as a community without requiring the cooperation of other groups. I say that not to indicate that we're trying to do this in opposition to the goals of other groups, but simply from a logistical perspective, we don't need other groups to take actions or have things ready for us to move on this. We could actually just accept this RFC PR, and now it's a thing, which has some benefits of us being able to move as a community. I do, for this particular governance framework, I do anticipate that better ones will come along that make this no longer useful. And nothing would delight me more than having better governance frameworks by other parties that are perhaps more appropriate that could in fact be used. But I'm also unwilling to wait for that to happen. I think that we need to move faster in order to allow the use of these early governance frameworks to be able to shape our understanding and practical knowledge of how to actually apply these things and use them for some small benefit. Now, Kyle's not here to say whether he thinks that's a good answer or not, but are there any questions about the nature of why I'm proposing it here as opposed to other places and whether this fits here or not?
Hi, Jim Mason. I think I'll say that I'm probably the least qualified person to offer the opinion, but that said, I would think here makes more sense only because I see this initially as the place you would implement that. And later on, the specifications could move, you know, as you say, to trust over IP.
Yeah, or entirely created somewhere else. And just, this one, it just becomes deprecated, right? I don't have any vision that this is the last one of these things we'll ever make. Hopefully, it's the first of many.
Yeah, so maybe I'm completely wrong, but I'll say, from my perspective, I'm looking at Aries as being what I call the first realistic production implementation of a lot of these features. And if you move them off somewhere else, you're not likely to get them implemented as quickly, in my opinion. Maybe I'm wrong on that.
No, I don't think you're wrong at all. And in fact, it's needs of this community that have driven the creation of these things. There's a couple of things that relate, and this is one of them. And they didn't exist anywhere else. Otherwise, we'd use them. And so I'm going to, you know, I think creating one here sort of makes sense. And if they, you know, there are emerge better places for them, I'm very happy for that to happen. The infrastructure that we're talking about for governance frameworks allows for the presence of multiple governance frameworks. And you can discover the common frameworks between two parties, which means that as we move to a new one, we have a built-in mechanism to do so, people can add support for the new one and we'll gradually, you know, products will deprecate support for the old one. And then there we are and we can still use the stuff in the meantime. Stephen, did you have a comment?
Yeah, I was going to ask you, this is email access. So as we roll out our Law Society credential, they are interested in sharing with potential verifiers information about this, about their credential, how it is issued, what the fields mean, and stuff like that. Is that the use case? Is that a similar use case to what we're proposing here? So in other words, would I make an RFC based on that particular schema to say, here's what we're intending by it?
So what I would do is create a document that both the human readable and the, you know, if it's functionally useful, the machine readable portion. But it doesn't necessarily belong here because it belongs to the organization that's actually doing it and creating that governance framework, right, which would be like the Law Society. So I do encourage the creation of a document and to have it hosted somewhere so that the same mechanism can work. But I don't think that Aries is the appropriate place to host that one because of the scope of that effort.
Okay.
So this one is here simply because there isn't really anywhere else for it to go to right now. And we're trying to act on it as a community.
Well, and it's very general purpose, right? The rules that we're talking about here are likely to be relevant whether you're using this email access test to start up some conversation in banking or education or between two people on a dating website or whatever. So it's very general.
That's a good point. So this governance framework is community managed, which means that we as a community get to accept changes to this governance framework with PRs. Right. That's the mechanism we have for this. So I have a list of questions here at the bottom that are super relevant. One of them is which networks, and we need a schema and issuers. So if we're gonna functionally do this as a community, this relates highly to the multi-network conversation that we've been having recently with the Indy Interopathon and other conversations. But if we're gonna functionally do this and try to make this real sooner rather than later, then how do we do this? There's a couple of things here, right? People in the community to volunteer to run such a service so that we can add them as approved issuers within the machine readable document that's associated here. And they would agree to the terms, for example, of the requirements for issuance. And this is pretty simple, but just describes how this is to be done. And they would be willing to host that service in some way and then be listed as an issuer here. Then, of course, we need to agree upon a schema and have a reference to the actual schema, which relates to the network question. Right now, we have multiple indie networks, and I don't know that we have to make this work on all networks. Part of me thinks that it would be at least worth the exercise to pick, one network that we have multiple parties willing to support to actually try this, and then perhaps expand the governance frameworks onto other networks as well as we're trying to solve this, in a way that makes it useful for the community. So there's two goals with this. One is just to try one, because we've talked and talked and talked about the potential applications of governance frameworks and machine readable governance frameworks, but we don't have any practical experience yet. So part of this is an academic exercise. The other part of this is very much a real thing that I hope we can do as a community to provide real value as we do this. Any comments on network issuers within the community that are willing to do this in schemas?
Well, is the question about which networks an attribute of the trust framework, or are you just looking for the trust framework to be written and then pursue as an independent question where we can get some adoption of it? I think the latter. I don't know of a place in the machine readable governance framework where it says this is constrained to the following networks, but maybe there should be. So that's kind of the purpose of my question.
So that's an excellent question. I think I know the answer, but I'm like really not very confident in this answer. I think that it would help to know specifically because of knowing which issuers are capable of doing it and which schemas are actually in use. And by schema, I don't necessarily just mean that there's an email attribute in the schema, but I was thinking we would actually refer to the network ID of the actual schema to use, which makes it so that it is very applicable or linked to those networks.
Well, but the whole network of networks idea is that I could publish a schema on, let's say, the Kiva network, and then I could reference it from the Bedrock network or something. So
you're totally correct, but we're not there yet.
I know, but are we writing a trust framework or governance framework for something that will cease to be useful once we get network of networks, or are we trying to write something that will remain relatively useful as that comes online?
My goal is for it to remain useful, but we may need to adjust the mechanics involved. For example, let's say we decide as a community that we need schemas on two different networks. Then we could reference those two different networks. When network of networks comes online, we could decide as a community to reduce that to one. Because of the ability to reference something on a different network. So does that answer your question about?
Well, I don't know if a crisp answer is even possible. I'm just trying to stimulate thinking here. I guess I had been assuming that the governance framework had no characteristic in it that bound it to a network. Now that you've said it, I'm questioning that and realizing there are a couple of different ways that we could do that. One of them, for example, is you can qualify issuers and say the only issuers are ones that can satisfy the following proof request, and your proof request could basically tie you to a particular network if you wanted. Anyway, I guess it's an interesting thing, and I'm now realizing that it may be particular, it may be quite valid to say there is a constraint on the scope of a given governance framework, namely it can only be used in the following networks. But I don't think that would be the normal thing. I think the normal state of a governance framework would be, you know, we have some rules that are human rules. We have a few that are machine enforced, but the machine enforced ones are not going to say you can't use this except in the following location. In the same way that when you write source code, you usually don't say you can't copy this routine into another module. You just assume it can be applied anywhere that you want to do a sort or something.
So from a conceptual perspective, I'm totally on board with the fact that this isn't necessarily tied to a specific implementation or a specific network. But from a practical perspective and trying to make this real, there's a little bit more of a need there. For example, it is my intent to load this file, you know, with a fixed URL into a mobile app. And in the mobile app code, it's going to use the schema information to pre-cache anything on the ledger required to for validation. And could in fact pre-cache information about the issuers if they are listed in this manner. And then when the mobile app receives a credential, it will evaluate that credential against this and other governance frameworks so that it has the potential of displaying a green check mark, hey, this abides a governance framework that you have enabled the UI element on the app. So from that perspective, I can't have a generic schema necessarily here. I believe I need a very specific one so that I know what I can actually pull down and pre-cache and have available. And that when I receive a credential, I can validate it against the issuers according to the rules present. So yeah, there's a little bit of a combination of both the conceptual and the practical here.
Yeah, I can't disagree with anything you just said. I would just say that the assumption that a schema ties you to a particular network is the assumption we're trying to break with network of networks. So if we start out being somewhat somewhat associated with a particular network on this framework, I won't say it's terrible, but I hope that we're pretty comfortable loosening that assumption later to where, like, just because the schema or the issuers did comes from network A doesn't mean it can only be used on network A.
Yes. I think that the language piece, the human readable piece of the governance framework, will end up being more idealistic in how it's applied. I think the machine readable portion is likely to be a current data representation of that according to the current environment it lives in, right? Which means that when we have the ability to do network of networks, then the ability to need to reference schemas on multiple networks in order to support them there is no longer a requirement and will be removed from the machine readable portion.
Okay.
That's what I'm thinking. Now, that ought to land as language in here, right? I think that having that language about the adaptation is good to make that clear in the document here itself, particularly since this is a super early one. Okay, and Stephen likes that. Lynn, you had a comment that I want to address in the chat. You said, I think that the network chooses the governance it wants to apply to itself and not the other way around. That is true of the governance of the network for the assets on the network. But what we're talking about here is the governance of credentials issued and passed around, which are not necessarily under the control or the scope of the network governance. Does that make sense?
Yep, I think I get it. Thanks.
Okay. So there's also governance of the network, but this is fairly different because of the scope of it. Okay. So is anyone bothered by the naming of email access as a name for this governance framework as opposed to ownership or control? Okay, I'll consider that one solved then with access. This question I have here has to do with redundantly storing information. And in particular, between the machine readable document, this piece here, and then the section up here. And specifically this relates to schemas and issuers. Should the issuers, the valid issuers, be listed here and the schemas be listed here, or should I only list them in the machine readable document and then direct people there to find out what they are? It's a little clear to have it in both places, but requires more effort and there could be some out of sync issues. Any thoughts there? In the future, I imagine a viewer that can render the machine readable file in a way that helps you naturally discover things like that. But in these early days, we're not gonna have that yet. And so the redundancy may actually be useful. Any opinions? Was the question clear enough?
I think it's simple enough until you get that to not duplicate information, but simply to refer to, say, give the path in the document to where they can find this. You know, to say it's under.
Right. Check under the schemas in the doc, or it's under evaluate the rules to see who can be an issuer, et cetera.
Yeah.
I think that Keith is right, but this one might be one where we should experiment. With a governance framework this simple, some of the tension might not really surface. But if you imagine like writing a governance framework for, let's say, doctors and hospital patients, there's a lot of complexities and multiple types of interactions, and there's legal and regulatory stuff. And I think it'll be interesting and we'll learn some things as we try to keep an alignment between the automated and the human versions of the information. And so I suggest that we just give ourselves kind of a tentative answer and make a note to ourselves that we'll probably have to learn from our experience to know what's the right sweet spot.
Okay, that's good feedback. I'll try one of them. And I'm also, in the adaptation language, I want to mention, Daniel, what you said was that this is functional, but is being used as an experiment in the community for the mechanics of this, which is good. Here's another question that might be fast. There's an implementation section here that I really stole from the RFC template, but I was asking myself, does this actually apply? Is it useful to list implementations that actually recognize this governance framework, or does that have no place in a governance framework?
Well, I feel like the theory of an implementations section in an RFC was a good one, but I think there's kind of a longstanding dissonance where Stephen Curran would prefer not to have that section at all, and we haven't been maintaining it in other RFCs with great diligence. We've updated it a little bit. And I think Stephen had a preference to go a different direction on this. I don't have a strong opinion. It is useful to have a place to list things so that somebody who runs into this can find out, you know, what kind of software might support this feature, who could I talk to about seeing it demoed, that kind of a thing. But how we do it, I'm less strong on.
So this is Drummond. I was late to the call. What, ask that question again, what you were...
So we're proposing a governance framework here.
Yeah, no, I know all that. This is your very last question.
Right. So we have an implementation section that RFCs normally have, which projects can add themselves to code bases and libraries, et cetera, as they add support for those things. Does that have place in a governance framework, or should it not be here?
Well, if this is a machine-readable governance framework, my answer is yes, definitely.
Well, there's two. So the top section is human-readable. That's this. This is the machine-readable portion down here.
Well, then my answer is easy. Just make it clear in the implementation section that it applies to machine-readable. If what you want to do is track who is using the governance framework, as in if it's an abstract governance framework that others actually implement, then yeah, you could track that too. And there is such an animal, definitely.
Well, this isn't abstract. This is a specific one, and it's not really designed to link to groups necessarily, but rather to software that actually does. Well, so then, someone lands at the governance framework and they say, wow, I want to interact with software that understands this governance framework. They could find somewhat of a list that would help them in that fashion.
I would just make it clear in the implementation section, you know, this is the governance framework, and then just say implementations that have implemented the code are here, and you can link to them.
Okay, so I'm going to keep it then, with the asterisk, Daniel, that we may want to evolve this in the future, but that way there's at least a place to stick notes if you have done that implementation, et cetera, and we can experiment with it later.
I think that's great, but could we just have one point of clarity? What does it mean to implement a governance framework?
I think that means, let me take an attempt at that. I think that means that your software is capable of evaluating received credentials against it. There's an extended answer, which isn't real yet, in that there's the possibility of referring to governance frameworks in other protocols. For example, you know, in the credential exchange protocols, we may say, I would like to issue you a credential under this governance framework. We don't have a way to say the under the governance framework part yet, but in the future we could do that. And the meaning there would be similar, meaning if your software is capable of understanding and operating against that governance framework, then it would be considered an implementation here.
Okay, the reason I ask the question is that I think implementation of a protocol is semantically different in the following way. When you implement a protocol, you must implement enough to complete a full workflow in one of the roles, right? You could implement the issuer role in the credential issuance protocol, but you couldn't just say, yeah, I've got something in my code that parses one message out of this protocol therefore I'm implementing it. I believe that many governance frameworks will be rich and have lots of possible features, and that most of the parties who use the governance frameworks will implement a small subset of them. There will be some parties that are, you know, trying to cover all the bases, but so I almost think that implementation might suggest the wrong thing, because I think that your software capable of you know, validating against the rules or whatever is a spectrum or continuum, not a binary state. So it might be better to just call this, you know, production uses or something along those lines, where we're saying somebody's using some aspect of this, rather than that here's some software that is guaranteed to, you know, fully embody it.
That's a really good distinction. And so it sounds like implementation may be the wrong word there. Do we have a guess at what might be a more accurate one?
Deployments or uses or something like that.
Oh, uses is simple. Let's go with uses until we come up with something better. Okay.
Well, Lynn Bendixson suggested use cases in the chat. So
use cases sounds like a generic, and I'm looking for specific use cases, uses here, not just use cases, but I like that. So yeah, let's go with uses. That's good. Okay. So the last remaining question I have is that I actually want to try this. I want to actually pick something, make it happen, and do it. Are there any parties here that are willing to run an agent and a service that are capable of issuing credentials in this manner? I asked for volunteers first before we talk about the specifics of network and schemas and everything else, because I think we can work those things out. But if we had volunteers, then I think we can sort of have the right discussions and make this happen mechanically. Of course, you know, subject to review of the group. Is there anyone that's willing to do so?
This is what we're already running, right? More or less.
More or less. There may need it. So BC Gov is a volunteer here. I would love there to be more than one, but I'm willing to not require that to make some forward progress here. I don't know that the our BC Gov group has any enemies in the community here, but I think that demonstrating that the governance framework is not about a single issuer might be a useful thing. Is there anyone else that's kind of on the fence there? There is code, by the way, that I'll mention too, that can be used. It may need adapting to your specific circumstance, but there is code that the BCGov team wrote to do this earlier, that you could have, of course, start from. Is there anyone that would be willing to at least attempt or investigate whether that would be something their organization can do? Okay, I will. Let's proceed with BCGov as a volunteer here. Stephen, I'll coordinate and ask questions, and we can figure out mechanically what's next to move this forward. And if there's anyone who wants to check or comes back and they'd like to, you know, offer that as a service to the community, that would be awesome. Please let me know, and we can work forward with that. Okay, and with that, I think I'm out of questions. Are there any other comments or questions about this specific governance framework that I'm proposing here?
No other questions. It looks solid. Let's see it out there working.
Okay, I need to make some updates based on what we talked about and resolve some of the open questions, and then we'll get details in it as we can, based on our forward progress with actual implementations here, and that'll be awesome. Cool. Okay. that closes out that particular item. So next up is the what's new section between version 1 and version 2. And here's a link. This link will continue to live as it this is linked in the wiki page here under the guide section. So if you want to get back here, this will always point to the newest version of the what's new section. So here's some quick summary of changes, and I'll try to organize this in a manner that makes sense to us as users of version 1. So we're calling the version that we are speccing out in the diff version 2 to differentiate it from the stuff that's in active use here in the Aries community already. So summary of changes, there's a formalization of the methods used in V1 that includes a JWM based message envelope. That is a spec, or a proposal to the IETF, for the JWM message format that fits in the JW star family of specs. We're also, targeting ECDH1PU as a standardized form of authcrypt. Authcrypt was a thing we did. It cryptographically makes sense, but there wasn't really a standard that actually wrapped that in exactly the same way. And so ECDH1PU is an effort to do that. Another change is that both the DID and the key of the sender are present in each message. The outer encryption layer uses keys. That's just keys from a security layer. And then inside of that, there is metadata, which includes a from field. And the from field is the DID of the sender. The rules are such that you need to resolve the DID of the sender and then check to see if the key used in the encryption layer was authorized to do so because of the DID document that results from resolution. That's similar to what we do here, meaning in version 1, meaning you're supposed to check the key actually in use against the keys that you know about in the context that you have to make sure that it's an authorized sender. And so that's a little different, but because there's a couple of cool advantages in including the DID in each message, it's a little bit more verbose, but has some cool stuff that I'll get into in a minute. We also have eliminated any special handling of peer DIDs. The connections protocol and the DID exchange protocol allow for the exchange of a DID document that was necessary for peer DIDs, and the ability to include information in a from DID or DID URL or related thing in the message means that the same information can be provided in more of a standardized way. There's also been a structure split between headers and body. This is not way a while back. Andrew Whitehead proposed some similar things. There is the encryption structure, and then inside of the encryption structure, there is a standardized object, which includes the message type and standardized headers. Headers are very much analogous to what we would consider a message level decorator in version 1. And then there's a body attribute, and the body attribute contains unique attributes according to the message type. And that's how we keep the track of those. There are still some applications of decorators, but they're substantially reduced. A lot of the decorators that we had have ended up as message headers to make that happen. And then we've decided to not use, to have a non-crypt encryption method. The availability of things like peer DIDs and the ease of use mean that if you wish to remain anonymous, you simply mint a peer DID, and then, which is relatively cheap from a network perspective, right? There's no ledger cost or anything involved. And then you send the message to the other party using the same authcrypt mechanisms that we have. And then you can decide when you want that relationship to end. So if you exchange a couple messages or only one, and then you're going to burn that peer DID and not maintain that key anymore, then you're capable of doing so as you desire. Or it can progress to become a more solid relationship over time. So there's some practical changes based on what actually happens. And one of the first most obvious ones is that the DID exchange protocol was designed to allow the exchange of DIDs since messages themselves contain only keys. The practical effect of having the DID in each message header means that each that the functional equivalent can actually happen in each message, where you discover the did and, of course, the key of the party that's sending you a message. And so the effect is the same, with the exception of handling did rotation, which was a regular part and, of course, something that you want to do anytime a did has been publicly visible, either in a URL or a QR code or something. And so there is a from prior header that travels alongside the new from when you rotate a did that that contains a JWT which authorizes the rotation according to the prior keys and the new did, of course, similar to the way that that mechanism worked inside of the connections and did exchange protocols, but in a slightly more standard way and in a header. So the side effect of having that happen is that rather than having a protocol handler for did exchange, which does this, the validation of keys and dids, et cetera, there's some message pre-processing that needs to happen where you see the from that comes in, you check it against the key, of course, that was used in encryption. You're gonna check that from did then against the known connections that you actually have. And it may be a brand new one you've never seen before. There's two cases that can happen. One is it actually is a brand new connection that you've never seen before, or it's someone who's rotating a did. And in that case, the from prior header will contain the information that provides the cryptographic evidence of that rotation and what the did used to be, in which case you can update the records that you have for the connection. We also discussed that just earlier this week on Monday that one of the ways that we can notify this is not agreed upon yet, but one of the ways that you could notify the other party that you are burning a did, meaning you're cutting off a connection in there and they can remove their information there, is by simply rotating your did to null, right? You would be able to send a message that indicates that you're sort of rotating it out of existence, which could be one of the methods used. So there's also the processing of the headers. I discussed this a little bit. You'll need to process from prior to the beginning of protocol message processing. There's no difference between ephemeral mode and full mode. In V1, we had this idea that you had a full mode where you actually went through did exchange and established a connection. And then there were ephemeral options where we carried along connection information along in the message so that you could have an interaction and return a message without actually going through the did exchange protocol. And there's not a technical difference anymore between ephemeral mode and full mode. You begin the conversation, you interact with them, and then you just tell them when the conversation is over, whenever that actually is, which provides quite a lot of flexibility there in the length of the interaction that you have. You might pass a single message, you might pass several messages back and forth that include protocol negotiation or some other sort of error messages like, hey, you sent me this message, but I can't read it, would be a useful thing to know, et cetera. And then we already talked about the peer dids in place of a non-crypt, and then the message level decorators are now represented as headers. And so that's an example there. Any questions? I went through that kind of fast.
But you did a pretty good job.
There's a couple minor things. One thing not listed here is that the mechanism of return route present in V1 will not be part of the core DIDCOM spec, but is planned to be an extension to the DIDCOM spec. This cleans up a handful of things, including the fact that it only applies to sort of last mile agent connections that need it, and not to all of the rest of the DIDCOM messaging that actually occurs. And so having that be an extension still allows standardization, but doesn't require placement in the top level protocol to that level. So you can be DIDCOM compliant and have nothing to do with the return route spec, which is not really different from what we have now, except that we sort of logically separate them. Other questions, concerns?
I think you got a pretty solid write-up in this section about, should be very educational for folks. I don't have any questions.
Cool. I have, so the other term that I didn't say here and is not actually in here is the concept of zero round trip. That's basically being able to exchange, not have to talk before you talk, which more or less results in the elimination of the data exchange protocol as it's redundant given the design. But it's the term really isn't present here because it's just a term we use during the design phase of kind of what we have here. But that is there. We do still have out of band invitations. They serve a really useful function for being able to present multiple alternative messages in the case that you're not sure which protocol the other party supports. So they are still present, but there it has been modified slightly according to the adaptations of version 2. We also have brought along feature discovery and trust ping as sort of core level protocols in that spec as well. There are some adaptations there, but they're very similar in spirit. Oh, and threading. Yes, thank you, Trey. Threading is present in the same mechanism. There are some additional headers. There's standardized headers. There's an expires time, which we sort of had overlaps conceptually a little bit with the timing decorator stuff that we talked about. But expires time allows you to simply indicate that, you know, after which time the message is no longer valid. There's also a created time in the message as well. And so those are standardized headers that that are a little different than how we've done that in version 1. So there will be some code differences, but the conceptual differences are pretty good. A DIDCOM message is still a DIDCOM message, and has very similar properties between version 1 and version 2, even though the mechanisms for doing so have been adjusted a little bit to formalize the methods we used in V1. Cool. If you have any comments, questions, or anything in the future, please feel free to reach out. And with that, the next section that we have, Stephen, is a discussion of indie revocation issues. You ready for that?
I am. Hang on one second. I'm just copying a link. Done. I wanted to do a little presentation since it's a complicated topic that's taken a while for us to figure out. I think I'll just share the screen. Okay, I assume you can see my screen. I'll put that out there and then I'll bring up chat in case anyone has any jumps in, wants to say anything. Okay, indie revocation blues, more lessons learned. So first of all, we implemented revocation in ACAPI. We were all excited. We then discovered that it was really hard for a controller, the component of an agent that does the business rules, the controller to be able to use the raw indie SDK calls to manage a registry. So we updated ACAPI so that it does most of the handling and the controller just sort of says, hey, I want to use revocation and I want to use a revocation of this size and I want to revoke this credential. And other than that, the framework took care of everything to do with tails files and creating new revocation registries because older ones were full and all those other things. So that was cut one. We got all excited, went ready to go again. And we had two problems. One was just an operational problem with some infrastructure we had. It was just doing, it wasn't set up quite in the right way. And what happened was we discovered that if anything goes wrong in creating a credential registry or in the processing of it, we can actually lose control of the revocation registry and we can't revoke any credentials. So this was a big problem. So we again had to step back and look at what we were doing internally and play with some things and make sure we had retry strategies and things like that. So bottom line is, okay, we're all ready. And then we discovered that we were having a problem with some wallets, even though they were all using Aries Framework.net, some wallets could handle the various use cases we were testing with revocation and others couldn't, and we couldn't really figure out why this was the case. Why was it working with some and not with the other? So I'm going to give a little lesson in indie proof requests and revocation. This is relevant for Aries, and this is relevant for other revocation strategies going forward, because some of the requirements are necessary. So, but we're discovering sharp edges that we think others will find the same sharp edges. So an indie proof request, when you're asking for revocation, you pass an interval, a from and a to field, with the semantic meaning, give me back a proof of non-revocation for some time within the interval. So if you say, you know, from now to now, you're basically saying, I want to make sure that it's not revoked now. And you're giving no room for, you know, any other thing but, you know, the very latest. Now, the very latest, that has interpretation to it. So I think one of the reasons for doing that was you can say, oh, from a half an hour ago to now. And then you can use, and the idea is you can use any, what amounts to a revocation event that the issuer has processed within that time frame. The prover, in order to do that, has to collect all of the revocation, in theory, anyway. I'm not saying necessarily they do, but in theory, they would have to collect all of the revocation entry ledger transactions in the interval, and then find one for which the credential they have was not revoked. That could be a fair amount of processing and lots of ledger transactions if you think about it. I meant to have a picture in here to show, but anyway, it doesn't matter. The common case people want to do is they want to prove a credential is not revoked now. So I'm going to talk about this, you know, what's needed in doing this, in what the prover has to do in a bit. But for now, you can think about it, but basically every time the credential, the issuer says, I'm going to revoke this credential or this group of credentials, that is a ledger transaction about a revocation event. And basically the prover would collect all of those events up within the interval that the proof request has and find one that it's not revoked and use that. And that would be sufficient for what the verifiers asked for. Common case is that to prove the credential is not revoked now, in quotes, where now means, you know, the current time within the most recent revocation entry within a given tolerance. And that's really up to the verifier to decide, and they can express that in the from and to fields. There is an alternate case, not that common, but not uncommon either, which is prove the credential was not revoked at some point in the past. For example, and this is the example in the Indy Hype that talks about revocation, that your insurance was valid on the date of an accident. And so again, you want to be able to show that, you know, on the date of the accident, the credential was active, even if it might be revoked today. So that's what the Indy proof request interval means. Now here's where we get into the interesting things that took us a long time to understand. Indy Node has a get rev entry read command transaction. You can submit a get rev entry, and it has an interval to it. It's got a from and to field, but the semantic meaning is completely different from what the proof request has. And that's actually can seem pretty obvious and is pretty obvious, but it is has caused a lot of problems. So people need to understand this. So it means provide the accumulators, the events at either end of the interval and the credentials that were either issued or revoked within that interval. So clearly not the same meaning, but there's no real documentation or there's not a lot of documentation to explain that. So That took us a long time to understand and has caused a lot of problems in kind of sorting out the issue. You cannot take the from and to field from the proof request and simply use them. This indy node command gives you the tools to provide the proof request semantics, but it doesn't implement them. And so anyone who's going to be implementing, you know, if you are going to be doing revocation with indy, be aware of this. And as I say, with any revocation mechanism, if it can be proven in the past versus current status. Basically, the problem is if you're given a proof request looking for a backdated revocation, you have to do a lot more querying of the ledger to construct the proof. And so what the indy node command is doing is it gives you the ability to do that, but it doesn't do it for you, and that gets difficult. It gets even more complicated because indy offers two mode of credentials, which is issued by default and not issued by default, meaning that a credential can be, a credential registry can either assume that all the credentials are issued by default automatically, which means they're all not revoked, even if they haven't been issued yet, or that as you issue them, you actually sort of unrevoke them at that time and then revoke them in the future if you need to. And then it gets really complicated, and I don't even know if indy supports this, but if a credential can be unrevoked, it gets really complicated because, for example, to determine this semantic meaning of the proof request sometime within the interval, if credentials can only be revoked and they can't be unrevoked, you would just look at you know, the very first one to see if it was revoked in the first one or not revoked in the first one, and that would be sufficient within an interval. But if it can be unrevoked, and if it's not, you would know it, there's no way to prove it, but if it can be unrevoked, you have to look at every ledger transaction to see if it was ever unrevoked. What we'd like to do is we need some way to handle this today, because the wallet handling and the verifier handling is very difficult given the semantics. So we need some sort of proposal that Aries indy-based credentials can be made to work. It's just too complicated, too much code processing to be useful today. So what we propose is we change the indy proof request, or we propose a convention in the indy proof request that you don't pass an interval, but instead you pass a timestamp. E.g., we strongly discourage making from and to be different. I've got it the same there, but it should be being different. So we want them to be the same. Usually that will be now, basically, but it could be earlier. It is implemented by a prover by calling in that indy node transaction with zero to the single timestamp value. You could, in theory, optimize, but I put again in quotes, I'm waving my hands with air quotes, cache the previous calls plus collect the latest, but basically you're going to have to do one single call to the ledger every time anyway. And we've done a bunch of testing that shows there's no performance difference whether you cache them and then collect the latest one, so you do one more ledger call, or you just do one ledger call every time. So it just really doesn't benefit you to cache them. And you retrieve a proof using the indy node returned accumulator and witnesses. So you're going to get all the revocations that have been done. So those that constitutes your witness, and you're going to get the latest accumulator value, and that is what you need to construct your proof. And it's going to always be the accumulator before the timestamp, since it was the one in effect at the timestamp. So And basically, if you know, it's up to the verifier to decide if they're willing to accept that one or insist that it be even closer. So in other words, we just, if we have a now and now, approver returns a result based on the latest at the time they constructed the proof. The verifier could discover there was a later one, revocation done, and decide to send back a, no, that wasn't good enough. But since they constructed the timestamp before the proof was constructed, that should be fine. So that should be a rare case. So that's that side of it. If a proof request has a different from and to sent, so in other words, if someone does try to use the range, the handling of that is really up to the prover and the verifier. They just have to do what they want to do, and the verifier decides if they accept it. The prover constructs the proof using an accumulator of their choice, basically that best suits what's being asked for, and they do as much or as little work as necessary to do that. And the verifier decides if the selected accumulator is sufficient. Both the verifier and the prover and the verifier have to do extra work in order to do this. So I'm looking for feedback on if people are okay with that. Basically with the ARIES framework.net and ACAPI teams, we've sort of decided this is the best we can do and what we're likely to move forward on. But obviously in an interop world, we want to be as, make things as understandable as possible. The problem here is we're dealing sort of with sort of indie SDK that's kind of in a stuck place. It's not moving forward particularly, and there's moves to move past it into new solutions. And so there's not a lot of likelihood that this is actually going to get fixed in some semantically useful, consistent way. Finally, the lessons for other revocation schemes is that semantics of past revocation status is hard, and I think intervals is probably not a great idea. I think it's too complicated, and you really just need point in time. Say, you know, was it revoked at this given point of time? So that was kind of the wrap up, but I would love to have feedback on this proposal, and if anyone representing any other, you know, groups or organizations doing different frameworks has any thoughts on that.
So this is not to sidetrack a little bit, but kind of my question that comes to mind when you're talking about all this, especially because revocation has been a huge headache for everyone. For a while. With Anencreds 2 and however revocation is handled whenever that actually comes out and is implemented on Indie, how would that change what you're talking about here?
Well, that'll, you know, in theory, and on, you know, what we've talked about for revocation 2 is more about scaling and eliminating tails file than it is about this interval idea. So to this point, any discussions I've had have not been talking about intervals. I think there is still, you know, there's been no talk of changing the proof request until I'm raising it now. And we haven't talked about, you know, how one would try to carry out the semantics of what an indie proof request is currently asking for. So this really hasn't been discussed yet in the revocation 2. That's why I bring this up, is even, you know, other revocation includes, you know, bid arrays that you know, Digital Bazaar has proposed, where you just publish a bid array and anyone can check at any time. Well, that there's no talk in that of how you would be able to prove revocation in the past. Was this, you know, was this credential revoked on January 12th, 2020? Unless there is a way that you can get the full history of all the transactions to the revocations registry, you can't do that. What I'm suggesting, though, is that ledgers are probably a bad idea, and that as we move into other other proof request formats, that we change to not use them.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense. And I think this is necessary work right here. And I think on behalf of a lot of people, I can say thank you for braving the whole revocation investigation. And I agree with your proposal here in terms of the timestamps.
Stephen, I missed the semantic difference between having the from and the to be the same time and having the from and the to being a range. Can you run that through me one more time? Does that make sense?
Yeah. If we allele, so basically what we're doing is we're saying that the from and to are the same thing, and then a prover would call Indy node using zero as the from in the Indy node call and the timestamp as the to on the call. And the result of doing that, when you use a zero as the from value on the Indy node call, you basically get a summation of all of the rev entry items that have ever been submitted. So what you get out of that is everything that's been revoked from time zero to the timestamp, and then you get the last accumulator before the timestamp. So by only having one value in the proof request, which is the timestamp, and then using this mechanism to say, okay, at that time, here was the set of things that were revoked.
So in normal mode, how it has been previously, does the from and the to mean the range with which you'll accept an accumulator? Meaning you'll accept an accumulator anywhere in that time range?
Correct. That's what the proof request from and to means. But the Indy node from and to means something different. And
right.
People have assumed they meant the same thing, so that's wrong. And the other thing is people have assumed that given a from and to, that in a single ledger call, I can implement this semantic meaning. And this semantic meaning actually is really hard to figure out. And that's why I want to eliminate it, is let's not have this because it's just way too hard to figure out. And if you really want to do that, then you ask a whole you can ask a series of questions, you know, do a series of proofs. But this is such an edge case that you actually get value out of this versus saying, I want to know whether it was revoked on such and such a time, or I want to know whether it's revoked now. Those are really the only two use cases that have any particular value. Saying, oh, anything between June and March is good enough, that's really questionable.
So,
and if you need to, you can broaden that. Yeah.
So the revocation entries on the ledger.
Yeah.
They don't all contain the proof of all of them. So you have to go find the one that actually mentions your specific position, or how does that work?
So this get rev entry, when you pass it a range, it finds the relevant entries around between those two dates and passes all of the list of things that have been revoked between the two. So it doesn't include any that were revoked before. So it assumes you've already got them, because you can't even construct the proof without having all of them.
Right.
So the purpose of the from and to in the get rev entry is to allow for caching, right? You continuously collect all the transactions over time and you cache them. It's got nothing to do with this idea of being able to prove within a certain interval. To actually prove within an interval, you have to know when yours was revoked, and then find an accumulator that is relevant to that. And you have to find it in that given interval that was passed in the proof request.
Right.
It's really hard. It doesn't even really make sense to do.
Okay, cool. Thank you for the explanation. And I agree that I think that squashing the semantic meaning is useful. I'm curious if we can invoke Brent here for a minute for any feedback that he has with deeper ledger experience.
I fully support the simplification of the calls on both sides. The range has never really made sense to me. Moving forward, when we do an OnCreds 2, we need to make sure that the interfaces that we build in Aries that will be extended to Ursa are cleaner than the ones that are currently in Indy right now. So basically big plus ones to everything that Steven said from my point of view.
Okay. I found actually the what Indy Node is doing basically does make sense. It's just that using it to get to, you know, what the proof request is asking for is really, really hard. And overly complex. It really doesn't need to. The verifier, you know, if the verifier puts now in, which is before the proof request is created or the proof is created, it should just always work to say, oh, I mean, it hasn't been revoked now, right. You know, as of this second, it should just work. And so I think this really does, yeah, enough. I think it works.
Awesome. Anything else, Stephen? We're about out of time.
Nope, that's it.
Well, sorry, you timed that perfectly. No. So no apologies at all. Awesome. Thanks everyone for coming. This was good. Please be involved in conversations, and we appreciate all the good work that you're doing and in the community. And we'll see you all next week.
Yeah.